Penguin Random House Audio presents The Siren Sang of Murder by Sarah Cordwell. Read for you by Lorna Bennett. To Billy, for putting up with the writing of it.
Preface to the audio edition. Simply put, this series could not exist without the singular character of Hilary Tamar. In Sarah Cordwell's own words, Hilary's voice was in my head before any of the plots. I knew from the outset Hilary must be an Oxford Don, but of equivocal sex and even equivocal age, resembling that precise, donnish kind of individual who starts being elderly at the age of 22. But keeping Hilary's gender ambiguous in these audiobook editions of the novels proved to be virtually impossible. After all, an actual narrator must take on the character of Hilary and give voice to Hilary's words. So, as you listen, please keep in mind these lines from The Sibyl in Her Grave, the last of Cordwell's extraordinary novels.
I cannot think that it would be seemly for me, as the historian of these events, Hilary says, to present myself as if I had played a leading role in them, thrusting myself on the attention of my readers like an amateur actor, cast as a spear-bearer, ineptly trying to shoulder his way into the spotlight. The place of the historian is not at the center of the stage, but in the shadows at the side, observing and explaining the actions of the protagonists in the drama. I shall not, therefore, take up your time and attention with any description or account of myself. Imagine, if you will, that you're encountering Hilary Tamar, as you might in Cordwell's original text, where without auditory timbre or pitch, you intone a voice based on your own assumptions. What assumptions do you make? What do those assumptions tell you about yourself and how you look at the world? Might it be useful to challenge or even erase them?
Prologue. There will be much disappointment, I fear, among my fellow scholars. From the senior common room of St. George's College, where anxious colleagues ask daily, "Finished yet, Hilary?" to the far distant lecture halls of Yale and Columbia, where I understand that the phrase, "in Professor Tamar's forthcoming publication," is constantly to be heard, the world of learning waits with impatient eagerness for my long-promised work on the concept of causa in the common law. How, then, am I to admit that I have yet again allowed myself to be led astray from the true path of scholarship, and that what I now offer my readers is no more than the chronicle of my defection? Would it not, perhaps, be more seemly to refrain from publishing any account of my investigation of the Daffodil affair, and to allow the whole matter to rest in obscurity? The mere facts of the case, after all, are hardly in themselves of sufficient importance to warrant publication. The reason for the high mortality rate among the advisers to the Daffodil settlement, the identity of the white-robed figure seen on the cliffs on Walpurgis night, how Julia Larwood came to be arrested in evening dress one morning on a beach in Jersey. Of what serious interest or value can it be to my readers to be informed of such matters? And yet, the case provides so striking a demonstration of the methods by which scholarship, when applied even to such trifling questions, may dispel error and reveal truth, that it will perhaps afford not only instruction to the public, but much-needed encouragement to other scholars. I have accordingly been persuaded, despite my misgivings, that it would not be right to withhold an account of it. It was far from being my intention, when I made my way to London shortly before Easter, to permit myself to be distracted from the labours becoming to the scholar. My former pupil, Timothy Shepherd, now in practice at the Chancery Bar, finding himself obliged by a combination of his professional commitments and his arrangements for the Easter vacation to be absent from London for a period of some 3 weeks, had invited me to make, during that time, such use as I might wish of his flat in Middle Temple Lane. Happening to have reached a part of my researches which required frequent visits to the Public Record Office, and which therefore could not conveniently be pursued in Oxford, I accepted his invitation with alacrity and gratitude. I regretted, naturally, that Timothy himself would be absent, for I have always found him a most generous host. But the friendship I had long enjoyed with other young members of his chambers at 62 New Square assured me of agreeable company when I sought respite from my labours. There was nothing to forewarn me, on my arrival in the capital, of the dark and sinister events in which I was shortly to become embroiled. The sun was shining on Lincoln's Inn Fields, the azaleas were blooming in the gardens at the edge of New Square, the barristers hurrying in wigs and gowns across Carey Street were exchanging seasonable gossip about who was going to get silk. It is on Maundy Thursday, as my readers are doubtless aware, that the Lord Chancellor announces which members of the junior bar are to be elevated to the eminent and lucrative rank of Queen's Counsel. My young friends in 62 New Square, when not engaged in deploring the inadequate remuneration negotiated on their behalf by their clerk, Henry, with their instructing solicitors, were innocently employed in activities befitting to the Chancery Bar. Selina Jardine, if my memory serves me, in a lengthy and acrimonious piece of litigation relating to the rights of the debenture holders in a public company. Desmond Ragwort, in advising on the construction of documents affecting the title to certain land in the West Country. Michael Cantrip, in sundry possession actions in various county courts. In the revenue chambers next door, Julia Larwood was peacefully studying the latest finance bill. Everything, in short, was proceeding in a manner appropriate to its nature and the season, with no such departure from the natural order of things as might be expected to be the portent of hidden danger and mysterious death. Also, at any rate, it seemed to me, I did not realize, of course, how odd it was for Cantrip to be sent to the Channel Islands. Chapter 1
No, no, let me go or I'll scream, cried the lovely Eliane, her beautiful eyes filling with tears and her bosom heaving under the delicate silk of her blouse, as she struggled to free herself from the vile embrace of the brutal barrister's clerk.
"Scream all you like, you little fool," snarled the clerk, his hideous features twisted in a vicious leer. "There's no one left in chambers to hear you."
But at that very moment there appeared in the doorway of the clerk's room the suave and aristocratic figure of the brilliant young barrister, Martin Carruthers.
"That's where you're wrong, Toad's Breath,"
he drawled with suave contempt.
"Take your vile hands off Eliane this minute. She may be only a temporary typist, but she is too rare and fine a creature to be touched by the likes of you."
"Mr. Carruthers, sir, I thought you'd gone home, sir,"
stammered Toad's Breath, cringing like a whipped cur before the young barrister's contemptuous suavity. Eliane gazed at Carruthers with adoration in her lovely eyes.
Cantrip and Julia were collaborating in the composition of a novel.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?